Okay.
At least that's what I think.
What do we want to start with? Well, we are now live. We are now live.
Oh God, I haven't done one of these forever.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom. The last time I said hi, Mom, on my live stream, it was followed by a series of invective that I'm not allowed to. I was admonished to not say in front of ladies today. So
it's funny.
I can't hold to that promise, especially if we invoke my mom. So
yes, Alex, you look so chuffed that your mom is watching. You look so happy.
That's what I say. Well, whatever.
All right, let's start. Thank you, all of you. Thank you, Efrat, for making this work. And thank you, Alex, for making this work three times this week. Lucky me, three videos with Alex this week. And thank you, Tom, for making this work as well. And I'll have the links to all your stuff in the description below. In fact, they may already be there. And there'll be a little snip of this video on YouTube, on both my YouTube channels, and a little slip on Rumble. But the whole thing will go up later on Odyssey and ThreeSpeak. So please support me there, bit.ly. Oh, okay, good. What's the cat's name? Because the cat can also...
Cow. Say hello to Cow.
Hello, Cow.
Hey, Cow.
I love cats. Okay.
All right.
But we started
with... the photo bomb.
Okay. And do all the business about whatever you do that you're supposed to do and I'm supposed to say. Okay. So where shall we start? Who wants to start and with what topic as we travel the macro universe?
I was going to say, I don't think there's anything going on, so we can just, like, bag this thing and go home.
Yeah, it's kind of been slow on the news front.
So boring.
You know, if we're going to start anywhere, I'm like, I want to get geeky and talk about the Bank of Japan, but I don't think we want to go there today.
Yeah. Tom, you'll turn the viewers off. You'll turn off Alex's.
Oh, I know. Everybody will just like, oh, never mind, Tom. Come on, stop it. So, I don't know. Where do you guys want to start?
Let's start with the Middle East and with Putin. Because I watched through Twitter yesterday how he was greeted. And then I saw what you retweeted about the Russian finance minister being part of the delegation. And then the way that Putin travels, flanked by four Russian jets, Air Force jets and stuff. And then what he did in the Middle East. Which one of you wants to start with that?
Well, just to clarify, it was the head of the Russian Central Bank, Elvira Nabiullina, who went with him. And that's actually very interesting that he brought her with him because Nabiullina is a very controversial figure, right? Because for years, we couldn't figure out who she actually worked for.
Right.
Did she work for the Russians? Did she work for the IMF? Like, she's IMF trained. Like, I have criticized Nabiullina 18 ways from Sunday. And then I remind myself that Putin is the ultimate mafia don. And very good at eventually giving people offers they can not refuse. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she's still head of the Bank of Russia, she is competent. But again, she's also Western IMF trained. And I think we can say safely now with her showing up with Putin in Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and clearly they're going to go over to the UAE, that the infrastructure for some kind of a new financial architecture is what's on the agenda. And make sure that everybody knew that Nabiullina went with him is telling you that that's where we're going. So now the question is, what are they trying to set up? And I have some thoughts on that. I've talked about it a lot recently, but what I think is going on with oil prices and Saudi Arabia and all of that. But you know, I'll throw that out there first and let you guys chew on it. And then we'll kind of go around the horn.
Cool. Efrat, Alex, either of you?
I'll just add that it's interesting to see how the Emirates is stopping. They don't want to accept dollars for oil trade anymore. I mean, that's a big indication. And in COP28, we're seeing the Emirates Sultan speaks against the move out of coal, oil and gas, which is a spit in the face for all these guys over there. It's like, it's exactly the place where he's not supposed to say it, and he said like the quiet thing out loud. And so you know, going against that green agenda and telling them, you know, this is how we roll, it doesn't work, like your way of rolling, that green way of rolling, we don't roll with that. And and I think that's another important indication. Then you see Putin traveling within 2 days to Emirates and Saudi and Iran and Jordan, everything in 2 days. It's like he's doing his round like his tour, his majestic tour. And I wonder how many oil deals were made during these days. I don't know. I mean, you guys are the experts. I'm just like looking at it saying what's happening here. And then tonight, I think it is tonight, he gave an official statement that he supports a two-state solutions for Israel and Palestine. And my guess is that we're going to see, I don't know when it's going to happen, but global powers present in Israel to kind of redraw the borders and keep Israel and Palestine each to their own sides and not fight any more kids kind of approach. Like some global powers coming into the country to redraw the borders, which is something that has been on the table for tens of years. We all know the story with the Yom Kippur War and in 73, exactly 50 years ago. And I love how the cabal is playing its symbolic tricks again, doing it exactly 50 years on the day. Actually, people are saying it's not on the day because we started this war on the 7th of October and the Yom Kippur War was on the 6th of October. But if you look at New York time or US time where Kissinger is, it's exactly, or was actually, it was exactly 50 years ago. And so we can reiterate what happened there just to remind people how in 1973, OPEC placed an oil embargo on the US and other nations that had supported Israel against the Arab states in the Yom Kippur War. And 5 months after the Bilderberg meeting in Sweden in 1973, Kissinger, which is, for those who don't know, he was an attendee of the Bilderberg meeting, but also the Rockefeller protege. And at the time, he was Nixon's Secretary of State. He engineered, in a way, the Yom Kippur War. I know many people would hate me saying that, especially Israelis, but you know, that's what I think. And provoked, in a way, OPEC's response, which was an oil embargo of the US and other nations that had supported Israel at the time. And
So I wonder, because I listened.
And I'm not an expert on this. I learned this history myself.
Yes.
I wasn't alive when it happened. My father had to be a soldier during that war and lost many, many friends. And it's not easy to learn that a lot of your friends got killed because someone orchestrated an oil deal in the Middle East.
Yes. And Ephra, I just wonder if history is replaying now with Putin traveling around these nations, say, and I think it was Alex Christoforou and Alexander Mercurius in the video they posted yesterday, and we're recording this on Thursday, 7th of December, where Saudi Arabia is saying to the US, you mess with us and you will be sorry. So hinting at a possible oil embargo and what that would do. Mm-hmm. So who knows, and who knows what else he's talking about, because he's not one for wasting his time. Alex, anything you want to say about Putin and what's going on, or what Efrat said?
Well, I thought it was very, very interesting. Remember, Tom, when December 2021, mm-hmm. When the Russians gave the draft treaties to the United States and NATO, and then you and I had a discussion. I never dreamed that they would actually go to war with Ukraine. I saw that they would not do that, but they did. Mm-hmm. But the other alternative that we were looking at was that they might seek to kick the United States, the Western alliance, out of the Middle East.
Yep.
I think that actually both are. I think that this is still happening, and they're still doing it. And I thought that I think that they're playing it in an extraordinarily sophisticated way this time around, because what I was fearing that would happen, and I thought that that was, I still believe that that was the intent behind 7 October, to provoke a concerted attack on Israel from Arab powers, from Arab nations. Because in that case, the Western nations, the Western powers, would probably come to the defense of Israel, and probably with some popular support. So you would get World War III. And I think that that's what they wanted. But after the initial, and then, you know, also if you paid close attention to the, you know, what did Netanyahu do? They went and they attacked Lebanon. They launched several attacks on Syria, accidental attack on Egypt. And on the other side, Hamas, were trying to talk up a general, you know, clash of civilization thing. They were saying like, oh, all Muslims should go out and, you know, attack Western powers. And they were trying, I think it was Mohammed Haniyeh who was trying to induce kind of Muslim leaders around the world to issue a fatwa obliging Muslims to go into like a jihad and to go and spill their blood and blah, 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 all these apocalyptic things. And then it just kind of, it kind of dissipated, it kind of petered away, and they didn't. What they did instead is they started attacking the United States in Syria, in Iraq, in the Red Sea. They started attacking Israeli vessels, commercial vessels. So they started these pinprick attacks through proxies, not even, you know, not even the Syrians, not even the Iranians, but through proxies, these little pinprick attacks, but every day. And in a way that doesn't get the collective West to unite and to say like, okay, this is our cause and we have to defend this. And so I think that now they're completely lost. And I would give also credit to Donald Trump for creating the conditions for this, because if you will remember in, I think it was 2019 or 2018, he wanted to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria.
Yep.
And he got sabotaged by the deep state. And then he said, all right, we're leaving the troops in Syria, but we're doing it for the oil. We're doing it for the oil. We're not, you know, there's nothing to do with terrorism, nothing to do with freedom and democracy. We're there to take the oil. So that seemed, you know, that seemed undiplomatic, unstatesmanlike, in bad taste. And everybody, you know, filed more hatred on Donald Trump. But what he did actually is he broke Western European nations' support for U.S. mission in Syria. Yes. So today, I think rather than West supporting the United States in Syria because they are fighting terrorism, they're on their own because they're there for the oil. And that was very clear. And, you know, it wasn't a small thing because there were these, you know, the CIA for many years and, you know, Brookings Institutions and the Atlantic Council, they had these brainstorming sessions about how to consolidate Western European support for what the United States was doing in Syria. So, you know, blowing the foundations from under that was actually a very, very interesting move. And a lot of the crazy shit that Donald Trump did actually, you know, in retrospect, he was consistently rolling back American imperial commitments around the world where he could.
Very good. At the edges, certainly. And
remember, he also wanted to withdraw troops from Germany,
yes.
Which, again, also that couldn't happen either. But
they had a war planned in Ukraine, and they didn't want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that it created a situation that now has put the Western cabal on their back foot. You know, I don't think they have an idea of what to do, and the initiative is clearly with Russia and China. And this is why we see this huge delegation of Russia going to the UAE, going to Saudi Arabia, going to Iran, and they're cutting deals and they're probably talking energy, they're talking nuclear power plants, they're talking defense pacts, they're talking security architecture. And I think that the United States and NATO are on the slippery slope out of that region. And I think that the consequences are going to be absolutely tectonic.
Well, the interesting part about this, Alex, is remember that I've been saying for a while now that there's a fundamental split between what Europe wants and what the Anglosphere, for lack of a better term, wants. Like the British American neoconservatives want X. And it's very clear that the Europeans, the Davos, for lack of a better term, want something different. The French and German deep state want a third thing, right? Because they want to replace NATO as the security guarantors and the military industrial complex in Europe. That's what they want. That's been very clear. Macron's made this clear. The Germans have made this clear. So you've got at least three different factions now making up, quote unquote, the West as to what's going on in the Middle East. And, you know, as I map all of the issues that Netanyahu has had, and it, literally within Israeli politics, and if you can speak maybe more clearly about this, that I map at least two different factions vying for control of the Israeli government. It's like constantly while you're like shifting back and forth between, you know, likelihood and the not likelihood, for lack of a better term. And this is constantly going, shifting back and forth, because ultimately, Israel is a British project, right? It's a British-American project. It's not a German project. It's not a French project, right? So it's always been a problem here. And so Syria is a lost cause for all of them. They originally were going to, you know, the whole goal of blowing apart Syria was that everybody was going to get their gifts, right? Turkey was going to get Idlib and the northern northern 30 kilometers. You know, the Germans and the French were going to get access to Iranian and Saudi, you know, Iranian and Saudi Arabian oil. That's what the JCPOA was about. Netanyahu hated it. The Anglosphere hated it because they wanted to sell American oil into Europe. Yada yada yada. Right. So you have all these competing things, and everybody was supposed to get their gifts, and none of them got anything because Putin moved in. You know, brought in a bunch of Su-24s and started, you know, supporting the Syrian army to bomb them and take territory back. And that eventually wound up in the Balkanized state that we have today, where we have the Turks are still in charge of Idlib, and, you know, the Kurds and American proxies, the SDF, are in charge of everything east of the Euphrates River. And then you still have the border patrol at Al-Tanf to, out in the desert to be able to, the Al-Bukamai border crossing between Iraq and Syria. So nominally stop Iranian support coming in to Hezbollah and to Syria across that border crossing. That's the way the map plays out strategically. So now the big question now is, they're all fighting amongst themselves because they still want their gibs. Like, and they realize as a failed project that there's always the possibility of how can we get the United States out of here so that then we can then not commit ritualistic suicide continuing this process. Because in the process of splitting these factions apart, which is what Putin did when he moved into Syria in 2015, and then engaged in very deft diplomacy with all of the other major players, he created OPEC Plus. Now we have BROPEC Plus. Okay, the Russians and the Saudis run OPEC. Right. So we now the entire OPEC speaks with a singular voice. When 4 or 5 years ago, it was being blown apart. So you now have Putin has deftly brought everybody on board to say, look, I punched the evil empire in the face in Syria, and I'm still standing. They punched back in Ukraine, and I'm stronger now than I ever was before. Now I get to walk in, and we get to start setting terms of how we are going to go forward as a bloc. When he did this in Syria in 2015, when he walked into the UN 2 days before that, and demonstrably said to the world, do you realize what you have done?
Yeah.
That speech
laid
the law down. And then him and Khamenei both laid the law down at the UN summit. And then Putin moves in 2 days later. And then everything after that has just been a thing that's been running since then. The key to all of this has been the way Putin handled the extrication of Russia from the Western financial system. Without him extricating Russia completely from the dollar, none of this happens. And this then goes back to the oil collapse of 2014, 2015, the deal that was made by China and Russia to make sure that dollars moved into Russia during the ruble crisis to redenominate all of Gazprom and Rosneft's debt and all that stuff. And I've talked about this 1,000 times for those of you who've heard me give this speech before. I haven't done it to Efrat, so I don't know if you understand my perspective on this, but it's important because as you talk about the historical parallels of the Yom Kippur War,
I'd love you to
repeat
it. I've got
the historical parallel today of what's going to happen with Saudi Arabia. Because China came in with their dollars and saved the Russian economy and said, we'll loan you the dollars, you pay us back in yuan. Okay. I have it on good authority. This is exactly what happened. My friend Vince Lanchi has a guy over in China that is literally, he's been talking with. So yeah, this is what they did. And they're doing the exact same thing all across Southeast Asia today. Indonesia, you've got companies that are in trouble with the strong dollar. Fine. We'll loan you the dollars you need, get out from underneath that debt, redenominate it in local currency, pay us back in yuan. We do plenty of trade. You should be able to do this. It's a soft way to internationalize the yuan. The SWIFT data is very clear. The yuan is starting to rise rapidly in finally breaking out of that 2-3% range of settling global trade. It's now at 5.3 as of the last SWIFT RMB tracker, probably be 6 or 7% by the end of Q1 of next year. So it's happening. Well, the same thing's happening with Saudi Arabia. What happened 2 weeks ago? Saudis and the Chinese signed a $7 billion currency swap deal, which was the precursor of them coming in to help the Russians. They did the same thing during the height of the ruble crisis to help the Russians get through their rollover problems that they were going to be dealing with at the end of December of 2014 and into Q1 of 2015. They had hundreds of billions of dollars that had to be paid off because it couldn't be rolled over because the Russians were cut out of the Western banking system. That's what's getting set up for the Saudi Arabians today. That's why it was so important that Nabi Alina was there. Because with Nabi Alina showing up, it's literally the Russians saying, look, this is how we did it. This is how we're going to support you when they go after the price of oil. And God fucking bid, you can see it. And they're bombing the price of fucking oil every day. Why is oil trading at $75 a barrel?
So hold on a second.
It's crazy. It's so obvious that that's what they're doing. They're setting up another run on the price of oil into 2024 to try and break the Saudis. The Saudis are going to break the peg. It's going to go crazy. I have another half an hour, but I'll stop here.
Yes, yes, yes. Efra, Alex, anything you want? You put a lot in there. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Efra. Efra, anything you want to say?
I just want to listen to Tom continuing.
he's good, isn't he? You should get him.
I'm learning. Come on, I'm learning.
No, this is such a deep. I was really glad you brought up the Yom Kippur thing, because the historical parallel here is the setup, and it's all about currencies. It's all about setting up the infrastructure necessary to break the reliance of the Saudi rial, which is pegged to the dollar, and the UAE dirham, which is also pegged to the dollar. That has to be broken. You know that full well that if those two things occur, that there's going to be consequences.
Yeah.
Because we have one mechanism by which to make people pay.
And you reckon that's the domino brick, the first domino brick that we're pushing in order to start a bigger financial.
Well, the thing is the interesting part about this is the following. If you bomb the price of oil, you blow a massive hole in the Saudi budget, because the Saudi budget is paid in reals, which is effectively paid in dollars. The Saudis pulled oil out of the ground at what, $9 a barrel, actual cost, but their budgetary costs are $80 a barrel. This is the part that everybody forgets about. So you break the peg to the real, you bomb the price of oil, all of a sudden the Saudis don't need $80 a barrel. Saudis can get away with you bomb it to $50 a barrel and you let the real depreciate. This is how the Russians did it. But the Russians were holding in 2014, they were trying to hold the ruble, below 30 to the dollar. And they were spending their foreign exchange reserves doing this. The Saudi royal family does not like spending the money that they've earned over the years. They don't like just handing it away. They're allergic to this. Mm-hmm. And they're very clear about this. And during the last oil crisis, we tried the same thing. Hey, by the way, this is what you do. You let us bomb the price of oil. You pump more and take market share from the Russians, and then you'll own the market share after the market comes back. Didn't work because Putin let the ruble float, and he kept his market share. As a matter of fact, he expanded his market share because he was able to undercut the Saudis. They were hemorrhaging 25-30% of GDP as a budget deficit for like 2 years. The Russians, meanwhile, were running a current account surplus, a trade surplus, and a budget surplus, and making money hand over fist. And Gazprom was paying out in depreciated rubles for guys pulling oil out of the ground at $8 a barrel. It was the simplest thing in the world. Like, just let the ruble float. The only thing is, you have to go through a nasty inflationary recession for about 2 years, where internally the Russians were running 12, 14, 15% inflation. But, they were going to go through it at some point. So at some point, you take the punch in the mouth, and then you get on with life. But then you're free.
Yep.
And that's what I think is I think what's happening now is that the together they can all turn around and go to the rest of the West and go, if you bomb the price of oil, well, and you can see why the Biden administration will bomb the price of oil. It's got three good reasons. One, it's an election year. They need gas prices down. Two, they need inflation down so they can get Jerome Powell to cut interest rates. And third, they need to, you know, keep playing this game of punishing BROPEC for getting out from underneath the old system.
Yep.
Those three things together tell you that they're going to stage a massive attack on the price of oil.
Tom, thank you.
That was the micro.
Thank you.
Alex,
you guys go.
Good job.
Nothing to add except, you know, we earlier we were talking about who does Nyabulina work for? Damn, that just brought back the visual of Austin Powers. Who does number two work for? Remember that? it just came all by itself. Sorry, I had to mention it.
Alex, I have to say your contributions have been remarkably profound. You know, your mother and now Austin Powers.
That's why I'm here.
Hey, Mom.
No, but you know, I do remember 2014 when they staged the attack on the price of oil. Oil price fell from $110 a barrel, and over the next 18 months, it declined by like 75% or more. It went to below $30 a barrel, which was absolutely shocking. It's been trading above 100 for 3 or 4 years before that. So what started happening is that ruble was starting to fall off a cliff, and Nyabulina started selling off the reserves to support the ruble. And that was a very interesting moment because, you know, when a central bank defends the quote unquote defends the exchange rate of the domestic currency, what they're actually doing is they're selling off the silverware, the nation's silverware, at fire sale prices. You know, and this defending the currency is the justification, which is completely phony. And I thought that was a complete disaster. And then Putin steps in and says, stop it, let the ruble collapse, which is the normalest thing in the world, because your domestic budget is in ruble. If ruble crashes, well, you're still selling the oil in dollars, right? So you're getting a lot more dollars for the same low price, right? I mean,
yeah, you're getting a lot more rubles for the same dollar price.
So the impact on your budget is minimal, or it's very, very muted. And so that was, I think that this is the moment when Putin stepped in and said, I'm the boss here. I'm the sheriff in this town. This is what you do. Because I think that she was getting her orders from the IMF or wherever the hell, you know, City of London, I don't know where. Mm-hmm. And she was going along with that. And this is where it changed.
Yeah.
It continued actually, Alex, for another another 6 or 8 months, because she immediately.
Tom, we lost Tom.
We lost him.
Okay.
I will ask a question in the meanwhile. Alex, sure. You tell me if this is related.
And the economy was starting to come back.
He's back. Right?
Wait, and the economy was starting.
Tom, we lost you, so we need you to repeat what you were saying.
You need to remind about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened? Starlink. Sorry, I got passed from satellite to satellite. Once the funding crisis was over, once the rollover crisis for the corporate bond problem for Russia was over, right around, by 2016, after she was still had interest rates way too high. Now she was choking off the economy on purpose, again, getting her orders from the IMF. And I was screaming about it on my blog and in my newsletter. I was like, oh my God, what is she doing? And then Putin comes in on a Thursday afternoon. Wednesday, she was supposed to cut interest rates. She didn't do so. Putin goes to the Bank of Russia on Thursday, and on Friday, she cuts by 50 basis points.
Mm.
Like, you work for me now, or you don't work, or you go to the gulag. Because and you know that she was holding it too high, interest rates too high, because the minute she did so, the ruble strengthened. the demand for rubles was so high, and she had restricted the supply of them so much that when she let some of them into the market was like, yes, more rubles. And so, like, literally, it was this way. When you see a central bank cut interest rates and the currency appreciates, that's a telltale sign that they were way too high.
Right.
Way too high.
Okay, now I want to bring it back to now. And
I want to ask a question, a quick one, sure, to Alex, because he was referring to selling reserves. Is it the same, like we just had in Israel last month, or I think it was, when was it, October, end of October, for the first time since the year 2000, the Israeli Central Bank sold the dollar reserve, and it announced a plan to sell up to $30 billion, because the dollar was going so high, up to 4.08 shekels per dollar, and they managed to bring it down a bit. Now, I'm not a financial expert, but just you were talking about selling the reserve, so it reminded me, because Israel has a lot of dollars, and the shekel was getting weaker against the dollar.
You know, I don't know why they would be doing this, but every time a central bank does this, I suspect foul play. You know, maybe they had a justification of some sort. I don't know, you know, what is...
They said it's in light of the war, of course.
Oh, they yes, have... you know, war justifies absolutely everything. you know, obviously they lie about these things. They're not going to tell you the truth. But I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't... it wasn't just flat out plunder, you know, not by Israeli government, but by whoever is on the other side of that transaction. You know, they use these crises to do all kinds of things that are always harmful to the people, but beneficial to the high cabal.
Yeah.
And then they say like, oh, it's the war, you know, oh, the oil price collapsed. Oh, you know, the currency is depreciating. 1992, Bank of England. You know, they bankrupted the Bank of England in this way. And who was it? It was George Soros and Druckenmiller and all of these people. And it wasn't only them. You know, they confessed it. They fessed up to it. But it was the whole episode just. The whole episode of how, because we know blow by blow how it went with the Bank of England, the absurdity of it, that anybody who is qualified to run a kindergarten would even come up with the idea of like, hey, let's sell off all of our reserves to defend the exchange rate of the British pound is so absurd that you can't help thinking like, why on earth were they doing this to begin with? It just, you know, the rationale doesn't add up, but somebody made billions while they bankrupted the Bank of England. They plunged the British economy into a recession. Millions of people lost their jobs. Hundreds of thousands of businesses shut down. It was a complete effing train wreck, predictably. And you ask yourself, who is running these central banks? And how could they be so staggeringly dumb? They're not dumb. They're just doing something else.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
This is just to complete the picture. This is $30 billion out of $200 billion that Israel has in U.S. dollar reserves.
Wow.
Yeah, and they didn't say for how long, like what will be the period that they will be selling it. They just said that that's the plan now.
Well, what's interesting is what Alex is describing was the fall of Margaret Thatcher. And that ushered in the government that brought in the one that moved them into the European Union. That was the goal of the exercise. And George Soros is a freaking MI6 asset. And he was made by these people and created to do exactly what he did. And then he has billions by which to then, you know, run a war chest to bring the rest of Europe into the European Union by undermining their governments through NGOs and this and that and everything else. This is their game. And this is why these people aren't stupid. They're just vandals. And when they're thinking about people who run any of this stuff as anything other than traitors to their race, their people, their country, they have no allegiances.
Other than power
and or their religion, which maybe is globalism. If they even have a religion, the closest thing they have is globalism.
That and the culture of climate.
Universal serfdom for us and unassailable power for them.
Yeah. Now hold on.
Sorry, I have to push back. I have to push back. That's grossly unfair. Do you forget LGBTQ?
Plus.
I had to flagellate myself for that one. Oh my God.
That's right. And European values. Thank you, Alex. Okay.
European values.
We can be critical, but we should be fair.
I want to bring you back to Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, Putin, the oil price crashing, the depeggle of the Saudi rial from the US. How and when is that likely to play out? And what's the impact going to be on the other OPEC nations, on Israel, on the European Union, on the United States? Who'd like to take that?
Sounds like Tom.
It does, but I was hoping to let the microphone go for somebody else for a little while.
Should I ever go?
What I'll say is this. I can make an argument as to what Putin was really offering in this charm tour, which is how do we use this against them? If they're going to run this playbook that they've run 1,000 times, how do we use it against them? It's going to be this first half of this year. Okay. And the reason I think it has to be the first half of this year is because we've just gone through this massive mass formation psychosis about the fact that the Fed is going to pivot and happy days are here again and we're going to have to cut interest rates and blah, 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 blah. None of that is true, of course. But this is all just a big blackmail operation to get Powell to speak dovishly next week. If Powell comes out and says the exact same thing that he said for the last 2 meetings and the last 4 speeches he's given, and he closes the fucking door on this idea that he's going to, you know, start cutting or even pivoting holding interest rates, cutting in Q1 of next year. They're all hoping for this and they need it to happen. There are many people out there need this, like they need oxygen. This entire run is going to happen within the next 3 months. And the reason for this is that they can keep inflation under control in the U.S. as long as gasoline prices are low. This is the work that I've figured out at this point is that in the current regime of the way our economies are operating in the post-COVID world, and again, this correlation may break down at some point, but as of right now, the United States CPI is a function almost completely of gasoline prices. So if you take a 4-month rolling average of the CPI increases and you plot that against the wholesale price of gasoline, you get two curves that like overlay on each other perfectly. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so inflation is down, but that gives Powell all the, and gasoline prices down. That gives Powell all the arguments and all the ammunition to keep rates where they are. Hey, we're at full employment. Gas is cheap. People are going to work. They're still spending money on basic necessities, but the credit impulse is down. And the people who are screaming about all this, who need lower interest rates, are the ones whose assets are getting gored. Right. So enter. For political reasons, they need to drop the price of oil to keep inflation low. But then eventually, supply and demand mismatches are going to exert themselves in Q1 or as late as Q2 of next year. This is why Putin is like, no, 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 guys, we stay together. We cut production. We cut production. We cut production. We cut production. If you cut production and float your currencies, you can weather whatever storm they throw at us. And then we're going to get the opposite trade 6-8 months from now, when the entire world wakes up and realizes that we're in a 5 million barrel per day deficit in oil, and oil goes from where they pushed it down to $40, $50 a barrel to $165, $180, $200. That is the judo move. Let them bomb the price of oil. Let them think they're in control. And then throw them. Judo. Let them, that's the direction they want, they're going, let them go that way and throw them on the ground. Aikido, judo, hapkido, I don't care. Pick a relatively soft martial art and you'll understand the metaphor. Like, there's no better way of beating somebody at their game than by letting them think they're winning. This is how the Russians beat us in Ukraine.
Yep.
They just slow rolled over and over again. Oh yeah, we're incompetent. Let the neocons think the Russians don't know how to fight a war in eastern Ukraine. Like, they've been fighting over this land for 500 years, 1,000 years, these people. Like, they don't know how to fight a land war in eastern Europe. Maron. So, like, this is, like, but let them think in their arrogance that they understand everything. And then just let them keep playing their arrogance out until they sit there and they realize, fuck, I'm out of moves.
Yep.
The game's over. And that's what's happening right now in Ukraine. And everybody's beginning to realize that the only ones who won't give up on this, all roads lead to London, is they're desperately hoping that they can draw the whole thing out and get their war, you know, against to destroy the Russians in 2025 or 2026 if they win the White House, which is why every GOP candidate is some, you know, some version of John McCain. Just, you know, either the Nikki Haley version or whomever. Like, they're all the same in that respect. So what I would say is, long story short, TLDR, you run this operation for as long as you can, and you keep inflation low through most of the campaign. But it also allows Powell to keep interest rates as high as possible unless there's a credit crisis somewhere, which will probably show up. And now I got to move to Europe and Japan to figure out how this is all going to play out. But the reality is that from Putin, and Putin's charm tour was to tell them, we can weather this. Let them do their thing. Depeg your currencies or get prepared for it. The Chinese have got your back. We've got your back. We've got the infrastructure in place. We've got swap lines in place. We've got the Asian Development Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. We've got the BRICS Bank. We've got ways of ensuring that if you run into trouble, we'll get out from underneath. And the only reason, in my mind, that they're even having to do any of this is because somewhere on someone's balance sheet, there's an awful lot of U.S. dollar denominated debt carried by somebody important within Saudi Arabia and the UAE, either Saudi Aramco, like, you know, analogous to Gazprom and Rosneft in 2014, or, you know, just some Saudi prince or some, you know, Emir has like a crap ton of U.S. dollar denominated debt that has to be either rolled over or hedged. Because if what I'm saying is correct, then you can expect the Saudis to get sanctioned by the United States and cut out of the American banking system.
Wow.
Or if it's a person who owes somebody billions of dollars, that they get arrested or nuts and sluts or whatever, the you know what I mean? And their assets frozen or however this works. It could be a person, Magnitsky Act style sanctions, could be a country, could be anything. But someone's going to do something. Something is about to.
Tom, do we know how much money the Saudis have at the Federal Reserve Bank?
No, but I don't know. It's a lot, probably a lot.
It was between $700 and $800 billion.
That much?
Yeah. But that's a couple of years ago. And I don't know. It might have increased since then. I mean, you know, they sold a lot of oil.
They're selling a whole lot of oil at a whole lot of profit. It's a good question, Alex. I didn't know that the number was that big.
No, very, very significant number. And I thought that their whole really, really weird project of that city, you know, like,
yeah,
that long
Neom
city. Yeah. I thought that looks so stupid. They must be trying to get their money out of the Federal Reserve Bank under some global, you know, great reset, build back.
Oh, yeah, that's a
pretext. They say, like, hey, we're doing all this. We're going to need all these hundreds of billions of dollars and then launder it through some stupid project just to get it out of, as much of it out from
the Fed. The stupid project that looks like the Great Reset itself, like the thing that Klaus Schwab and Yuval Harari, like, you know, do
the
unmentionable
line.
Stuff
it's
that that, that, oh, that only a CNN producer could get caught on a Zoom call doing.
Yeah.
But, That's the closest thing I can come to being, like, you know, politic, guys.
It's Build Back a hell of a lot worse.
Yeah.
So. Okay. All right. Then how is this going to play out in Europe? Actually, no. Before that, right, one of the things that I'm curious about is how does the Israel-Gaza conflict fit into the larger global macro picture? Because I can see with Ukraine and Russia what the intention there was, to destroy Russia. But with Israel-Gaza, like, how does that
fit? I think the intent was to destroy Iran, Rich. I think the intent was to destroy Iran.
Was.
And I think that it's not going to work. Well, you know, what did we see a couple of days ago? That they were sending a carrier strike group into the Persian Gulf. You know, a magnet for a false flag Gulf of Tonkin something.
Mm-hmm.
But then, since then, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians, I think, announced naval exercises, which I think is maybe a way to try to counteract that, to preempt. I don't know how, you know, I don't know how you would do that. But, you know, you're not just going to let, you know, a sitting duck of a U.S. carrier strike group sit there in the Persian Gulf waiting for, you know,
yeah,
something to blow up and just say, like, ah, it's the Iranians, let's start World War III. So I think that for the moment, nothing happens. I think that the conflict in Israel is going to have to die down because it's not going anywhere. It's just,
they already gave it a deadline, Alex. Mm-hmm. I think it was yesterday or today. The Americans told Bibi that he needs to finish off by, I think, the end of January or something like that. He's got a month or so. Yeah, they gave him a deadline. They told
Bibi is very good at listening to the Americans.
Yeah, that's their problem.
But on the other hand, yeah, they do have leverage. They can make his life difficult if he disobeys.
And I'm sure they've got the runner-up waiting in case.
Who is it? Who is it, Efrat?
It's hard to tell. I have my guesses, but I would guess it would be someone from the left wing, like a former general, like, for example, Benny Gantz, or, for example, someone that is not currently in the roster of members of parliament, but will be put inside, like a former general or something, someone with an army background. That's my guess, but it would be a left-wing one.
I hear that Juan Guaido is available.
Who?
Juan Guaido.
Yeah, he's available. Soon Zelensky's going to be available.
Who's going to be president of Venezuela? It didn't work out, so now he needs a job.
Got it. Got it.
Alex is in fuego today. Even though I know that's not, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure Israel wants to end up like Venezuela and, you know, Gaza. And I'm seeing how we're ending up as the next Ukraine. But that's what they wanted. But I don't think it's going to happen, just like Alex is saying. I think they had an intention to take us to a big war with Iran. And it looks like no one wants to play with the U.S.
I don't think the U.S. military wants any of this. I think this is the part that everybody's missing, is that the U.S. is not a monolith. Okay, I described three different factions within Europe. There's five factions vying for power in the U.S. at this point.
Wow.
Mm. Or two of them are actually, you know, are actually American patriots, for lack of a better term. Okay, most of them are not. And when I see the Biden administration, which I've always mapped to Obama, which then maps me back to Davos, COP26, the all those people, I say to myself, oh, look, Bibi went off half-cocked on Gaza, and Biden got the call, which is a mushroom anyway, say, no, stop it, and then we're going to get rid of Bibi after he's made Israel unacceptable. Here's the thing. It's hard for you guys to understand because none of you are American, and I don't mean that as a pejorative. Right. I'm immensely. The internal weirdness of American politics is really important. Actually, it's not even that. I don't mean to be condescending. American politics is really murky. Like, I wouldn't presume to speak for Israeli politics any more than I would speak for. I try to speak about British politics, and I usually get out over my skis. But American politics, especially this year with the importance of the 2024 presidential election, is very, it's everything right now. So let me put a scenario in front of you. How do you get Gavin Newsom into the White House?
How? Okay. That's a nightmare.
Well, you've got to start. You got to start by looking at the what's going on in the American electorate. Mm-hmm. The center of the country regrets voting for Joe Biden.
Yeah.
They've become hardened anti-war. They're becoming hardened anti-interventionists. They're tired of the inflation. They're going broke. Everything bad is happening to them. They see their Congress refuses to legislate. And when they do legislate, the money seems to go overseas and none of it is spent here. So you've got the emergence of what I would call a radical center coming in the United States, which basically says, fuck the world, America. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I don't mean Trump per se, but Trump is the candidate that best represents that, right? Mm-hmm. On the other side of the coin, how do you invalidate the rest of the GOP in order to ensure that they're unacceptable so that Gavin Newsom looks like a viable option?
Oh, by everybody
by having the GOP come out in favor of genocide of Palestinians for a fucking BB-led bloodbath. Who in the hell, what soccer mom in Gainesville, Florida, or Jacksonville, or Wichita, or wherever, is going to vote for freaking all these people who came out and said, yeah, Ben Shapiro was right. We should just you know, kill them all like God sorted out. They literally turned everybody who was thinking about voting Republican to get rid of these ungodly, horrible Bidenistas who clearly at this point everybody looks at and goes, these fucking people are just traitors. But how do you get them to not abreact and vote for the other party? Well, you got to then make everybody go, I'm supporting these genocidal fuckwits? Oh, no. I didn't sign up for that either. I got pedos on one side. I got genocidal fuckwits on the other. Who do I vote? Who do I run with? Who do I vote for?
Well, that's interesting.
And then what happens is you get rid of Biden and you put Newsom in his place. Newsom runs on getting the United States out of Syria. Okay. Backing off in Ukraine. Making a deal with China over... Making a deal with China over Taiwan, which was never, ever, ever going to be invaded. It's all false. That's all a false narrative, too. Mm-hmm. And the big one that just popped into my head the other day, thinking about this, are the tariffs. How do you make Trump? You have to hang Trump if he's going to be the nominee. If they can't put him in jail, your fallback plan. I got hit Nikki Haley, who's insane. Who's, you know, John McCain with, you know, the Waffle House waitress version, or you got Donald Trump, who's the architect of stealing the Syrian oil and leaving our troops there. It doesn't matter that John Bolton and everybody else betrayed him. Trump's one weakness is that he never backs down on anything that he put in place. He still backs the vaccines. He'll go if he has to. I can just see Donald Trump in this first debate with Gavin Newsom, and Newsom brings up Syria. And Trump, like, justifying it. And then the tariffs on China, which are the stumbling block. When Xi was in San Francisco, what's the one thing they didn't talk about in the news? The one issue between the United States and China. The big 800-pound gorilla in the room. The Trump tariffs. When they're not talking about it, that's all they talked about. This is the way it's playing out for me. I hope I'm wrong. I really, really fucking do. But, man, oh, man, like, how do you get Gavin Newsom in the White House?
Well, and it's interesting.
Gavin Newsom in the White House, you get Nikki Haley, and it's just as bad. As I said, as we said at the top of the show, what do they always give us? A Hobson's choice between two unacceptable people.
Nikki Haley sounds positively, certifiably insane.
She is.
But
it's in the water in South Carolina, by the way. No offense to South Carolina.
Lining up behind her.
They're lining up behind her. Okay, so let's bring up Jamie Dimon. I was chatting with a friend of mine yesterday about this. And let's talk about Wall Street. Wall Street generally gives to both sides. But they generally, in New York, go 65-35 Democrat versus Republican. And they generally all vote Democrat. The big ones. The Solomons, the Dimons, whatnot. generally in the Democratic Party. For even for Diamond to, I didn't even catch this. Again, this took me a couple of weeks to process until a friend of mine finally just said it to me yesterday. Like, look, Diamond came across, and the best he could do is he crossed the divide, the unbridgeable divide of, no, Wall Street, not going to back the Democratic Party this time. You guys, it's okay to not give money to the Democrats. As a matter of fact, don't give money to the Democrats, because then they won't have the money to have a topic ticket, run all the down the money for the down ballot races and all the rest of it. Even, and at this point, Nikki Haley is the one that they can best control, even though, well, she's crazy.
Wouldn't you put forward Nikki Haley because you want Gavin Newsom in the White House?
Maybe, but you know, she's also like, a fault. I think Diamond is resolved that Trump is going to be the nominee on the right, and they can't stop it. I honestly think that within about 2 months, we're going to figure out that they can't stop Trump unless they put him in jail or shoot him.
Well, there's that conversation growing in the mainstream media in the West.
But they won't. They won't shoot Trump until after the election. They'll shoot him between November and the inauguration, and they'll try and saddle him with somebody horrible. So Haley, running for VP. Vivek Ramaswamy, running for VP. And the best thing Trump can do is go completely off the board. And his best choice at that point would be anybody else. And the three of you would be a better choice.
I was thinking you, Tom.
You don't want me as president.
No,
VP. You used to watch my old live streams, Rich. You know exactly what I would do. Afghanistan now, so I would have to update my, okay, Vlad, who are your Spetsnaz going to kill now? As I live stream it at the inauguration. No, like you don't want my Roger Waters version of reality, folks. It looks bad. I like, oh, an eye for two eyes and a little bit of scary. Like, libertarian justice theory is not good as president.
No, you and Trump in the White House, that'd be so entertaining.
Oh, it would be hilarious. Are you kidding? But no, I'm not doing it. They'd remand my ass to Guantanamo before that ever happened.
Okay.
I'd have a date with being waterboarded like 18 ways from Sunday. But, it's a living.
Right. Okay. Alex, anything you want to say, add, or take it?
I want to say that Ezra was waiting to say something.
I just wanted to ask a silly question. Do you really believe all this politics bullshit of right and left and Republicans and Democrats? I mean, this is all very serious, but in the end of the day, are they not just puppets as well?
They are.
They are, right?
But the GOP and the DNC are. But these are the vessels by which anybody is. The bigger question is, who's now behind them?
Yes.
And manipulating things. Yes. I think there are some very, very powerful people in the United States right now working very hard to get control of things. I think that we have reached kind of peak clown world. Mm-hmm. And now we're trying to go, okay, this is as far as we're willing to go. Like, everybody's looked into the abyss and went, oh, we're going to do that? No, we're not doing that. And then you've got to then figure out how to get there. And because this is a big battleship, it has to be turned around in a very small space. And there are so many competing factions, and Rich, you know how hard it's been just Brexit. Like, how badly the civil service has undermined Brexit, and how, you know, like, all of the competing factions and these people, like, you know, like, you thought it was going to end when they finally got rid of Mark Sedwell. Well, guess what? It got worse after they got rid of Sedwell. We thought he was the devil. Like, and it's 10 times worse now than it ever was.
Yeah.
Because they never stop, because these people get infinite at-bats. And the only way to get this whole engine of corruption to stop is to make the dollar so goddamned expensive that it kills everybody's leverage and you wipe them all out. That's why, I mean, look, the way the bond markets have traded over the last 3 weeks, if I were Federal Reserve Chair, I would raise 50 basis points next week and put everybody on notice that I'm deadly fucking serious. Banks, go raise capital. Commercial real estate guys, take the fucking losses. We are done with this bullshit. America is for Americans. We're done with all that. Because look, guys, there are new rules coming down the pike as far as how treasuries get repoed and all that stuff. It's all starting. There's a new market for U.S. treasuries, and it's all going to have to go through clearinghouses, and those clearinghouses are going to require 100% collateral. And when that happens, all the rehypothecated bullshit that's been going on for years within the repo markets stops dead cold. Just like Basel III and the gold coverage, right? Alex, I know you know about this stuff, right? The Nets funding ratio for gold, that, you know, gold will be a tier one capital asset, and, you know, it's going to have to be backed by physical, and it can't be backed by any rehypothecated assets. The same thing is coming for the Treasury Department for U.S. Treasuries in repo transactions in the United States. So all those dollars that are being de-dollarized overseas are going to have a domestic sink, heat sink, to be dumped into to collateralize the new repo markets in the United States. And that is what Powell is trying to get us over the line towards. Implementing SOFR was the first part, and now that, and now all of a sudden, you know, that there's it's going to be a different world than we've all lived through our entire lives. And because of that, these titanic changes, the political stuff is the political air of desperation that we all can see and feel. I mean, we're all talking about it. Mm-hmm. It's coming because these people can see this stuff coming a mile away, and they're trying to wriggle out of the Chinese finger traps that have been laid for them. Mm-hmm. Putin's done it with his relations in Saudi Arabia, but, you know, we've seen it in all these different areas, and they're all coming. And if I'm wrong, well, I am epically wrong.
Okay. Tom, I got to say, before I go into my next question, is this has been a fabulous education for all of us. Really, really great. Thank you so much.
I haven't done a lot of interviews recently, Rich. So like this stuff's been laying out here over my head for like 2 weeks now. And I'm like, how much do I talk about? Because I got to write an issue in a week. And like, oh shit.
So, you saved all right,
but I'm sorry, guys. I hate to hog the microphone, but unfortunately,
No,
not at all. Efrat and I are both learning. I think this is the first time you and Efrat have had a conversation. And then Alex is coming in with some very pithy, profound contributions every now and then that keeps it all rolling. Thank you so much, Alex. No, it's just really, really great. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Now, Europe and the euro. So the Saudi DPEG, oil price being crashed down. Well, that's going to be good for Europe. It's going to be good for Davos and in Europe and the EU. But the DPEG of the dollar, that's going to be chaotic for Europe, I think, from, you know, I don't have the sort of insight that, or the training or experience that you, Tom, have, or you have, Alex. How's it going to play out for Europe?
Rich, I don't know. Europe is such a cesspool.
Oh, sorry, Alex, one thing. And there's all these elections happening as well in Europe.
It's that. It's, I don't even get it. It's like Spain is slip-sliding into a civil war. Germany is turning into like a totalitarian nightmare. Italy is falling apart. We're being overrun by migrants.
Ireland as well. I do a fair amount of coverage on Ireland.
Ireland is turning into a totalitarian dystopia as well. ECB is... No, sorry, not ECB, European Commission has lost all legitimacy. It doesn't seem to me that anybody cares anymore. You know, we're all supposed to be unquestioningly implementing East European Commission directives. Nobody cares. You know, the Polish farmers are blocking the border with Ukraine. I don't know what's going to happen, but it seems to me that we're going in a direction of a really, really ugly collapse, which I don't know when it's going to happen. Yeah, you know, oil price is going to go down, then it's going to go up again. They're printing the euros like there's no tomorrow. They're raising interest rates also, which I don't know what they're thinking. But, you know, we're already on
QE and raising rates at the same time, Alex. They're doing yield curve control and raising rates at the same time. It's an absolute nightmare.
For the digital euro that happened a month ago.
But I don't even think that's going to work out either.
Yeah, me neither. No, they're just trying to normalize it.
And, you know, they're not giving, you know, they're saying like, oh, you're going to have a choice between, you know, digital euro and the normal cash.
Yeah.
They're not doing this because they're being kind of democratic and giving people the choice. They're doing it because they have absolutely no confidence that the whole thing is going to work at all.
Yeah,
and I have full confidence that it isn't.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I mean, could you put more incompetent people in charge of like probably the most complex project that's ever been contemplated ever in history of the universe.
It's, you know, we're tyranny of midwits, right? The convocation of midwits running around, and this is the problem with midwits is that they think they're smart.
Yeah. Well, I don't think these people even think that they're smart. How could you?
Well, I mean, you know, they've been given enough participation trophies over the years.
They've been given enough of,
you know, I mean, look at Ursula von der Leyen. Every time she fails, she gets a promotion. So why don't you just keep failing? Mm-hmm. I mean, where do you go from there? Like, you know, I mean, they're put in place because they're good soldiers.
Yeah.
The system of failing upwards. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are subordinated to you in this hierarchy know exactly the kind of wanker that you are when you're supposed to lead them. And so when you we lost Tom.
No,
wanker. Hilarious, dude. Wanker was the last word I was expecting to come out of your mouth.
Like, you know, I love it because he speaks so seriously and then he says a word like wanker in such calmness.
Even though your mom is watching empty. Alex.
I love Alex's delivery. It's just fantastic.
I'm profoundly frustrated mm-hmm. about the fact that we're being led by people that you wouldn't elect even to run like a community football club.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, in Croatia, Alex. We said like you wouldn't let them keep three paper cut sheep, you know?
These are the same people that you looked at running for student government going, yeah, okay, you want that job? It can happen.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't vote for them then. Like, it's the same thing. And
they're
in power because they were placed there. They were given orders. They're very good order takers. And they're very good implementers of what it is that they've been told to do. And they don't know how to improvise. None of these people are jazz people.
They don't have any talent. They don't have any conviction. And it's their only way they're going to have any power by bending to the will of those that bribe them and control them. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but you know, like that. What kind of power is that when everybody you have to rely on to implement these measures knows that you're a loser, that you're incompetent, and that you have no idea. You know, like everything you ever touched in your life turned into excrement, into dung, and now you're telling people, "Well, do this and do that," and we're. I don't know. You know, like it's. It's like John Kerry announcing, you know, grandiose announcement that the United States is going to go off of coal, that they're going to decommission all the coal power plants by what was it 2035? It's like
good luck with that.
What is wrong with these people?
Well, because Alex, again, I just wanted to say, like, when you only have one script, then you just stick to it. These people are your typical customer service, first level customer service people. They have a script, they stick to it. They're just like Yanis Varoufakis said during the Greek debt crisis. You go in there, you've got all these ideas, you present you work your ass off for weeks trying to craft a solution that everybody can live with, and we're going to get this, it's all going to work, and we've got a plan, and we want to pay you back, and we want to do the right thing, and blah, 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 blah. And then you make your presentation, and they look at you like you just sung the Swedish national anthem, and then they go, so we're going to like fuck Greece and take the Parthenon, right? Right. Okay. Yeah. Good. And then we move on. Like this is the world that they live in. And you know, and the reason that they're so caught up in this is because no one has ever finally just said to them, "Okay, it's time for you to go to the home." They don't believe that they don't have any power. Again, COP 28, not COP 28.
Yeah.
But you see, I see great danger in this because I don't understand what happens if all the power structures fail, if they can no longer command. You know, like what happens if law and order breaks down?
And I'm on both gold and guillotines, Alex. You know that.
Yeah, more authoritarianism, more resistance.
Sure.
Like what's happening in Ireland?
And then they'll gaslight us by telling us that Donald Trump will be the authoritarian. Oh my God! Have you listened to the histrionics coming out of the American media about Trump? They're all on point. If he gets elected, he'll be a dictator. The people are going to go to jail. Like, no, you're going to go to jail. It'll be bad for you. Won't be bad for me. Won't be bad for my wife. Won't be bad for, you know, my gaming buddies down in Gainesville. Won't be bad for the guy who works the new jockeys to register over at the gas station. It'll be bad for you, Joe Scarborough. It'll be bad for you. Lindsey Graham, this one, that one, whoever it is, Joy Behar and all the rest of them. They're the ones who will be destroyed. They know that they are guilty of crimes against humanity. The only thing they can do now is double down and hope they win. Because what's their option? To admit that they were wrong? To admit that they did what they did? Then they go to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect your $200 billion. Right? So you have to just keep fronting and hoping. Because they're like liars who have been caught in the lie, so you just keep lying. Narcissists don't back down, they double down.
Okay, now bringing it to the European politicians and the European leaders, and what you said earlier, Tom, about how the Gaza-Israel conflict served to make the GOP unpalatable to the center. How do you see, and this could be any one of you, that playing out with the European body politic? Because I saw a little video of Keir Starmer. He was arriving in Glasgow. Oh my God, the reception that he got! It's like Trudeau. Trudeau gets everywhere wherever he goes in Canada. This was now happening to Starmer, and it's fractured the Labour Party. But the Tories aren't that different, really. So how is
Tories have been destroyed? The Tories are just controlled opposition. The same thing with the GOP in the United States is. I mean.
What about for the European Union and the German government? And
I think you have a bigger problem in that. I saw something the other day. The big news coming out, Poland, right? Poland's been buying gold like it's going out of style.
Yeah.
And the dumb take, the low information, the low quality take is that, oh, well, the Poles are buying gold in order to, you know, get to the level necessary to make the European Union's transition to a gold standard occur. I'm like, the guy from Gainesville Coins came up with this one. This howler the other day. I'm like, that is not why the Poles are buying gold. If you look at the European countries, the Eastern European countries were all traditionally buy gold. Hungary bought gold recently. Poland's buying a lot. Serbia buys a lot every day. Blah, blah, blah. It's the countries that all still have their own currencies. So ones that aren't on the euro. The euro collapse is coming. The Poles are getting ready to leave. The Polish Central Bank is getting ready to getting ready for political chaos in Poland and the breakup of the European Union. Where we have after this election, we still don't have a government. Yeah. Donald Tusk and the Davos coalition didn't get enough. Law and justice didn't get enough. We've got a fractured, and the people are saying, we don't want either of you people. We want Poland for Poland, and we're done with all of this. And, you know, look, the same thing happened in Turkey. Poland is in the same position that Turkey was in after we blew apart Syria. Poland was promised Lviv, whatever, tomato, right? That portion of Ukraine when they won, when NATO won. That was their gift, just like Erdogan was promised Idlib and a whole bunch of, you know, and all of that. But they had to take in a whole bunch of refugees from the war, right? Erdogan took in 3 million refugees. He used them as blackmail and leverage to get concessions out of the European Union. They strung him along. Turkey never joined the EU. Well, guess what? Poland's the same problem because they're already in the EU. And they didn't get their gibs. And the British have left them out to hang. And it's clearly they're not, if they're going to get their gibs, it's going to come from Putin, not from the EU.
Yeah.
And so now there's a lot of soul searching going on, I think, within the Polish political, soup, for lack of a better term. It's like, what are they going to do? and someone is going to finally, and it's the same thing that happened in the Netherlands. Geert Wilders is winning, right? And then we're going to have, like, we've got state elections in Germany coming. What a German patron pinged this to me this morning. Said, oh, by the way, tomorrow is the 2-year anniversary of the formation of the current traffic light coalition in Germany. Guess what happens at that point? All the ministers get their pensions. So if you want to know why Christian Lindner, the head of the FDP, hasn't pulled out of the coalition yet, it's because he's waiting to get his friggin' pension guaranteed. So it opens up the window that we could have a collapse of the. I mean, it's just. I don't know if it's bullshit or it's not bullshit, but it's like it's just. It could literally come down to the individuals at the tops of these parties, just waiting to get their thing, and then oh yeah, no, we're out of here.
Yeah, because they can see the.
And then because all you're waiting for is the next state election in Germany to go way against the current government, and then no bribe from Davos is big enough. Especially if there are bribes coming from somewhere else, i.e. from Wall Street. Okay. And the question is, who's got, you know, whose balance sheet reigns supreme for the bribes?
Yep. Okay. Efra, Alex?
Yeah, I want to say something not related to this question because I have no idea what will happen in Europe, and Alex said it. Right. But I do want to add to something you said, Alex, about the right people just taking orders. And one thing that I saw today, the journalist in Israel called Carolyn Glick, she exposed that there's a this has been ongoing. It's not new, but I think most people don't know this, not in Israel and not overseas, but retired major generals from the army in Israel. When they retire normally quite young, like 45 to 50, let's say. And they're used to receiving very high paychecks and a lot of, a personal driver and like good conditions. And all of a sudden they're unemployed. And normally what happens, there's like this route that is designed for them to go and work in the US for some research institutes. And one of them could be the Martin Indyk Research Institute, the same Martin Indyk that worked for Bill Clinton and was receiving, and that specific research institute was receiving funding from Qatar. And these people then go back to Israel and in a way, I would call this the deep state, right? They would navigate Israel's policies under the liking of Martin Indyk Research Institute or the U.S. New boss that they have. And they're like former major generals, like they're highly respected people in Israel. And they would be funded by this foreign arm. And they would, in a way, try to circumvent things in Israel to go a certain direction. And we're talking about thousands of people that are in this group of retired major generals. I mean, so I saw that that video interview of hers, the journalist in Israel, talking about that and the fact that Qatar has funded this research institute. And that is, to me, that is so interesting because you're talking about people who follow orders. These are the best people that follow orders. And once they finish their army service, they, in a way, look for a new boss to keep their high standard of living so they could continue, you know, getting those high wages and their the comfortable life that they're used to. But this time it's not the Israeli army anymore, or the or they may not have the best interest of the Israeli people at mind. Now they have a new boss overseas. So it's like
same boss that supports Hamas.
That's amazing insight, Efrat. That's this Qatar that you've been mentioning. Is that same Qatar that's been giving hundreds of millions of dollars to Hamas?
And is that the same Qatar that today I saw, and I still need to check it out and verify all this information, but I saw today another article from a French magazine talking about Benjamin Netanyahu receiving funding from Qatar to sponsor the Likud party, his right-wing party. I didn't know this, and I'm not sure whether this is correct or not. It needs to be validated. But, and the article is from the end of 2021. It's not new. So I need to go dig a little bit. But the Qatarians definitely have a very interesting role in this game.
Yes.
From all sides.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, also Qatar has uniquely, for Middle Eastern countries, they have a very deep relationship with the British government and the British defense establishment. Yeah. They share two Air Force bases in England, where Qatari pilots and British pilots train together on their Typhoons or whatever jets they are buying from Great Britain. And then, you know, today, if you support Hamas, they haul your ass to prison, right? In Europe, in Germany, in France. But Qatar, which has given hundreds of millions of, I don't know, like $300 million a year, $400 million a year to Hamas, they just got, a month ago, they got a $9 billion loan from UBS or Credit Suisse, whatever it was. That's really funny how that works, isn't it?
And isn't it also funny that one of the major players in the negotiations of returning the hostages, the kidnapped hostages, the Israeli ones from Gaza, were the Qatarians? They were the ones now a major player in these negotiations. Like, we go to them and ask for their help. They're not the only ones, but they're definitely one of the major ones helping bringing back the Israeli hostages.
Okay, Tom. Thank you, Efrat. Thank you, Alex. Tom,
this is the part of the program where I sit back and listen because I don't. Keep going.
Okay,
carry on.
Okay. Well, look,
I think that what is obvious here is that we have some kind of a very far out deep state agenda playing out where. You know, they're using Qatar because what is Qatar? It's nothing, right? They're using them as the hub for these clandestine terrorist activities. They're funding both sides, you know, divide and rule. Like, let you and him fight, you know? That's the same old deal. You're funding both sides. You have people inside both structures that can pull the levers and press the switches. And it kind of reminds me a lot of, you know, the way they used Baku back in the early 90s when they ran the whole, you know, jihadi network where bin Laden was. No, it was Richard Secord. It was General Richard Secord who set up a CIA front oil company in Baku in Azerbaijan, right? And then he also set up an airline which secretly flew jihadis that Osama bin Laden recruited and trained in Afghanistan to then, you know, start these terror organizations that attacked Russia in Chechnya and in Dagestan. It sounds like a very similar playbook, except, you know, it's not Baku this time. It's Qatar.
Qatar in Arabic.
Sorry?
It's Qatar in Arabic, because I worked there for 4 years. I worked in Qatar, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm going to finish this up, right? Because it's time. And I just really, really appreciate each and every single one of you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Any quick last words from any of you?
I plan to, I'm not suicidal. I plan to live on many years. I'm not ready to give out any last words.
I know I haven't been around, you know, done a lot of media recently. And it's not because I have information leading to the arrest of Hillary Clinton. So if, you know.
Anything for you, Efra?
No, I mean, it's really good to be back on the interview set because I was refusing a lot of interviews in the last month because of the situation and in light of the new regulations that have been put in place in Israel to lower national morale and, you know, be criminalized with incitement for talking against the country or whatever. So I've been very careful. And a lot of people have been arrested in Israel. And there are some really strict regulations in place now in light of the war. I've been reporting on it on my Substack. So if you want to see what kind of new rules we have in place, you can check it out. I made like a list of 7, and I'll give another update soon about stuff that is happening around Israel. But just one thing, if I can mention, that is happening, and to me, most people don't talk about it, but I pay attention. So, and this is quite strange for me, just in light of the recent visit from Elon Musk to Israel. The Gaza envelope area, the same area that has been infiltrated and attacked on October 7th, has been announced to become a green energy island, right? They're going to rebuild it back better now. Yeah, greener. And they have a program to support renewable energies, to meet the climate goals of 2030, which Israel is failing in. And they basically said that alongside, you know, energy production, green energy production, water systems and all this crap, they're like renewable. They're also going to make sure that this area has a solar field and infrastructure for charging electric vehicles. Surprise, surprise. Yeah. Musk has just visited.
Just to remind everybody that climate change is cope for middle-class Americans for feeling bad about their colonial past. It's really not that hard. And, you know, that's all it is. When the truth of the matter is that it's just, you know, look to who doesn't produce hydrocarbons and then understand who's pushing this. Right. And sure. So, you know, it's the same thing that Alex and I have talked about forever. 2024 is going to be the year of collateral. Collateral is going to be the word. Alex and I have been talking about it together for a couple of years now. It's going to be and oil is the collateral for everything, ultimately, because without oil, and, you know, there is no economy, there is none of this stuff. One of the things I want you to put in your head in all my crap spilling about, you know, bombing the price of oil and taking out the Saudis and blah, 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 is that you watch who's buying the energy stocks that get beaten down during the next beatdown. And you'll have your answers to what's going on. But I can tell you flat out that if I were all of these climate ninnies, the one thing I would be buying is Shell, Exxon, Chevron, this one, that one, because of course I'm getting them at stink bid prices. Yep. Not hard. All right, folks, it was fun. Efrat, it was very good to meet you. And
you too, Tom. I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
What I do. I'm not sure if any of it's right. I just throw shit at the wall and then we see what happens.
Tom, you have a great track record.
I miss a lot. But in order to hit, you got to be willing to miss.
Yeah.
Right. And so.
Well, I guess we have to do another one just on gold and Bitcoin because I'm curious to hear from you about that.
Don't get him started.
Bitcoin.
But that's a whole.
Bear assets. That's next time. Bear assets. The year of collateral. Bitcoin's collateral, so is gold, so is oil.
So, that's right. If you can hold on for a few minutes afterwards, I want a quick word with you. Alex, Tom, thank you all very, very much. Thank you, everybody, for watching. This will go out recorded, like I said. I'll have the links to Tom's, tomluonga.me, Alex Craner, Naked Hedgy, and Trent Compass, and Efrat's Substack and her Twitter. Really, really appreciate it. And between now and when I see you next, please keep remembering that the Great Reset will fail. And fill your pockets with peace and freedom. Crypto Rich, Crypto Alex, Crypto Tom, and Crypto Efrat signing out. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rich.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.